I was thrilled, honored, gratified, not to say shocked, to learn that Jacob Have I Loved was to be given the 1981 Newbery Medal. But there was a problem. "What shall I say in San Francisco?" I cried out to my husband. "I don't know what to say." He proposed, "Thank you." "Yes, but what next?" A writer I know suggested that it was time I said to the American Library Association, "We have got to stop meeting like this." I was sorely tempted, but these speeches tend to get preserved, and who wants to appear flippant to posterity? I complained to another friend that everything I thought of sounded either coy or dumb, and she replied, "Well, I don't think you need to worry about coy. It's just not your style to be coy." It took me several seconds to get it. Carl Purnell would have caught on sooner. Into the midst of all this inner turmoil, there came one cool, clear voice. It had a distinct Chesapeake Bay Island ring to it. "Oh, my blessed, wouldn't you know, here I bring up a prize catch and the fool's fixing to ruin it for me." So with Sarah Louise Bradshaw prodding me at the end of her skiff pole, I was made to turn from the frazzled writer to the book. How could I forget that it is books that are being honored, books for children? And who could be happier than I to join in the 60th anniversary of such a celebration? Those who know me best will testify that I am far more of a reader than I am a writer. If you understand that, you will understand something of what it means to me to be sharing this occasion with Jane Langton and Madeline Lingle, writers whose extraordinary vision lighted many of those dark days when I was still struggling to write fiction that someone would find worth publishing. And Arnold Lobel. There we are, Lynn, John, David, Mary, and I, all crowded onto one bed, five heads poked together over the pictures, warming ourselves on Frog and Toad, delighting in them and in each other. In those days before I had ever met any real writers, much less become one, the books of these three were among those wonderful works that were enriching my life and the lives of our children. If Arnold will allow me to steal a phrase, it is a moment of true happiness to find myself in this distinguished company. And, speech or no speech, I am very grateful to Jenny Cruz and the members of the Newbery Committee, as well as all of you in the Association for Library Service to Children, who have made this possible. Thank you, John Patterson, for your love and patience and unswerving conviction that I can, too, write another book. Thank you, Lynn, John, David, and Mary, for all the joy you bring us, as well as your total lack of reverence, which keeps me anchored to the real world of gallon milk jugs and swimming meets and socks that never match. Thank you, Harper and Row, and thank you, Kroll. You know how I love you all. Pat Allen, thank you for liking my peculiar title and insisting that it stay on the book. And Virginia Buckley, what more can I say to you, Virginia? Surely you know that any honor that comes to a book we have done together is more than half yours. And Jean Nimovich, one book will never repay you for all the wear and tear of friendship, but it was all I had. Thank you for liking it even before it had a gold seal. I'm glad your name is in it. Finally, the Womeldorfs, thank you each one. I am proud as well as grateful that we have belonged to one another. But this speech must be concerned not with me and my myriad debts, but with a book. One of you asked me 3 years ago what I wanted to do next, and I, seeing not the glamour of an award ceremony, but the pile of mess upon my desk back home, said, "All I want to do is write a publishable book." At the time, my aim seemed far in excess of my grasp. Lauren Wall and Bill Morris would call me on your behalf, asking me to speak, and I would whine, "Oh, Lauren, oh, Bill, please, I've got this book I want to write. That sounds pretty convincing for a few months. But when more than 2 years go by and there is no tangible evidence that any such book exists, someone might begin to think of the tailors who toiled night and day on a magnificent new wardrobe for a certain emperor. But neither Lauren nor Bill ever pried or even raised an eyebrow. There were times when I suspected that they had more faith in this invisible book of mine than I did. At one point, near desperation, I said to Virginia Buckley, "If I ever finish this book, Virginia, I'm going to mail it to your home address in a plain brown wrapper, and you must promise me that if it is no good, you will not only refuse to publish it, but that you will never tell another soul that it exists." Virginia, being a gracious person as well as a great editor, did not even point out whose integrity was being impugned by such a demand. She took all my melodrama with a simple nod and one stipulation. "Just don't put a pseudonym on it," she said. I didn't have the nerve to tell her I'd seriously considered it. Then there were those of you who would ask most politely the perfectly logical question, "What are you working on now?" only to receive a snarl or a disconsolate mutter in reply. Well, this is it. This is that book that I would not talk about for so long, even with my husband or my editor or my closest friends. The book that took me months to begin and that I often wondered if I could ever finish. This is Jacob, whom I have loved off and on for years. Whenever I speak, one of the questions sure to be asked during the question and answer time is, how long does it take to write a book? As though books, like elephants or kittens, had a regular and therefore predictable gestation period. Often I will begin my reply by asking, which book? Trying to indicate that each book is different and has its own unique history. There is, however, one answer that would be true in every case. But whenever I try to put it in words, I find myself swimming in pomposity. The correct answer, you see, is this. It has taken all my life to write this book, maybe longer. The conflict at the core of Jacob Have I Loved began east of Eden in the earliest stories of my heritage. Cain was jealous of his brother, and, we are told, Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and slew him. If, in our Freudian orientation, we speak of the basic conflict as that between parent and child, the Bible, which is the earth from which I spring, is much more concerned with the relationships among brothers and sisters. "A friend loveth at all times," says the writer of Proverbs, "but a brother is born for adversity." They never taught us the second half of that verse in Sunday school. The fairy tales, too, are full of the youngest brother or sister who must surpass his supposedly more clever elders or outwit the wicked ones. In The Uses of Enchantment, Bruno Bettelheim suggests that a great deal of the apparent rivalry between brothers and sisters in fairy tales is in actuality an Oedipal conflict, since the usual number of brothers or sisters is three. In the stories of two brothers or sisters, Bettelheim suggests that the story is about the divided self, which must be integrated before maturity can be attained. Although both of these explanations make sense, I do not think that we can avoid the most obvious meaning of the stories, which is that among children who grow up together in a family, there run depths of feeling that will permeate their souls for both good and ill as long as they live. I was the middle child of five, swivel position, the youngest of the three older children and the oldest of the three younger. Although I can remember distinctly occasions when I determined that someday I would show my older brother and sister a thing or two, and I have no recollection that my two younger sisters were plotting to do me in, still, the stories in which the younger, by meanness or magic or heavenly intervention, bested the elder, always bothered me. They simply weren't fair. The divine powers, whether the Hebrew God or the European fairy, always weighted the contest. And although the civilized Calvinist part of my nature spoke in quiet tones about the mystery of divine election, there was a primitive, beastly part, a Caliban, that roared out against such monstrous injustice. Novels, I have learned, tend to come out of the struggle with the untamed beast. It was the fall of 1977. The great Gilly Hopkins was at the printers. The hoopla following the National Book Award for the Master Puppeteer was over. And I had finished the curriculum unit on the Shang and Zhou dynasties of ancient China. I could no longer put it off. I must face the beast in its den, or what was worse, that stack of blank paper beside my typewriter. How do you begin a book? People always want to know how you begin. If only I knew. Think of all the agonizing days and weeks I could have spared myself, not to mention my long-suffering family. They know better than to ask me about my work when I'm trying to start all over again. My replies are never gracious. There must be a better way. My way is to write whatever I can, hoping against hope that, with all the priming, the pump will begin to flow once more. Here is a sample from those dry, dry days in the fall of 1977. Her name is Rachel Ellison, but I don't know yet where she lives. It might be in the city or in the country. It might even be Japan. It seems important to know what her parents do. How does religion come into the story? Will Rachel be burdened by guilt as well as everything else? Will her relationship to God play counterpoint to her relationship to her brother? I said brother, but perhaps after all it has to be a sister. I'm avoiding sister because it comes too close to home. Am I contemplating a book I can't write? The feelings start boiling up every time I begin to think about it. All raw feeling. No story. There has to be a story. There has to be a setting. There has to be something more than boiling anger. Why am I angry? Where is the key that turns this into a book? Jacob and Esau, Cain and Abel, Rachel and Leah, prodigal and elder brother, Joseph and his brothers, the sons of David. Lord, make my brother give me the portion of the inheritance that comes to me. Maybe Rachel's brother is an adopted South Asian war orphan. Sister. Excitement to pity to rage to hatred to some kind of accommodation. Step one. Go to the library and find out everything possible about Southeast Asian orphans. And I was off on a wild goose chase that lasted for days. All November and December were spent in pursuit of similar geese. How long this would have gone on, I have no way of knowing. But Christmas came, and with it a gift of grace. It was not even intended as a gift for me. My sister Helen gave our son John a copy of William Warner's Beautiful Swimmers, Watermen, Crabs, and the Chesapeake Bay. I began reading it during those low after-Christmas days, and by the time the new year dawned, I had a place to set my story. The Chesapeake Bay, less than an hour from my front door. In the bay, there are many islands, most of which are not inhabited. Two of the inhabited islands, Smith and Tangier, are separated by miles of water from the rest of America. Even now, with television, telephones, and in the case of Tangier, an airstrip, they seem a world apart. My story was going to be chiefly about a young adolescent who felt terribly isolated. Of course, all 14-year-olds who are not social clones feel isolated. But what better way to show this isolation than an island? Rass, the name for my island, squirted up from my subconscious and has yet to reveal its source or meaning. Rass would be none of the actual islands, but something like all of them. Now I began going to the library, as well as to the bay, to find out everything I could about the Chesapeake. At the same time, I began setting down on scraps of paper and 3x5 cards ideas as they would occur, things that might happen in the story. What about a grandmother or other live-in relative who spouts pietisms? She may be the one who brings up Jacob Have I Loved theme. Old man gets off ferry. He left 30 years before and has come back. Takes shack at farthest end of island to live as recluse. Make the kid sentimental. Moons over tombstone. Tries to convert friend who is boy to sentimentality. These are bound with the same sturdy rubber band that holds notes taken from reading and observation. Pain of being stung in the eye by jellyfish. How peelers are separated. 2 weeks to go, snots, greens, white sign crabs. 1 week, pink sign. Hours to go before busting, rank, red sign. Reactions to thunderstorms. Chopped down mast. Climbing up it, swinging hatchet at the Almighty, daring God to meet him halfway. Cats around garbage dump scavenging. Big cats. Wintering birds on Smith. Oh, my blessed, what a noise. There's another large pack of 4x6 cards, but I think all those cards were collected much later. I think so. Not that I ever seem capable of dating. But the cards are ones I remember buying at Gray's Pharmacy in Norfolk. So between the first batch of cards and the second, there came the January 1978 announcement of a Newbery Medal, the acceptance, the knowledge that after 13 years in Tacoma Park we would be moving, the discovery of my mother's terminal cancer, the choice of Gilly as the Newbery Honor Book, the move to Norfolk, mother's death, and a National Book Award. That is not everything that happened in our lives between the fall of 1977 and the spring of 1979, but it may give you some idea why poor Jacob was languishing. But even as I present to you these impeccable excuses, I know in my heart that the reason I nearly despaired of finishing this book was more the internal storms it stirred up than those that came from without. I was trying to write a story that made my stomach churn every time I sat down at the typewriter. Love is strong as death, says the writer of the Song of Songs. Jealousy is cruel as the grave. I did not want ever again to walk the dark path into that cruelty. Yet even while I was having trouble going back into my young self, I was being drawn more and more into the world of the book. I knew that in Rass I was trying to create a facsimile of the Bay Islands, but my feeling as I worked was not so much that of a creator as that of an explorer. Here was a hidden world that it was my task to discover. If I failed, this world would remain forever unknown. I do not mean by this that I thought I had a monopoly on the Chesapeake Bay. Not long after I had begun work on my book, James Michener's massive Chesapeake was published. I read it with dread, fearing that he might have preempted me, might have discovered my world. But he hadn't. He couldn't have. The Chesapeake world I was exploring was mine alone. No other living soul had access to it unless I could somehow reveal it in Jacob. I think I have finally learned that no one can steal your novel from you. No matter how closely his material may come to yours, he can only write his story, and you yours. The intricate design of an individual life upon some portion of the outside world. I knew, for better or worse, that if I did not write Jacob, it would never be written. I say my world, my story, but it hardly ever felt like mine. For one thing, it refused to obey my rules. I have always sworn that I would never write a book in the first person. It is too limiting, too egotistical. And yet, the book refused any voice but Louise's. Oh, well, I said to myself, I'd better get it down any way I can in the first draft. In the next draft, I can write it properly. At some point, I wrote a very peculiar note to myself. Not content with writing a book in the first person, I apparently was thinking of writing it as three first-person stories. One for Louise, one for Caroline, and one for Call. Perhaps, I added, end with a fourth section, which goes back to Sarah Louise and ties the story together. Heavens above, I think the only reason this book ever got written is that I would regularly lose all my notes. I must remember that next time. Take all the notes you wish, but do not fail to lose them once you start. By now it was the fall of 1979. I was piling page upon page, revision upon revision, until finally my husband made a strong suggestion that it was time to get the manuscript out of the house and to Virginia Buckley. I think he felt that if drastic steps were not taken soon, he would be living with Jacob in an eternal triangle. He was right. I had become so entangled in the story that I did not know if it was worth further effort, if it would ever be a publishable book. So I sent it. Virginia got it on Friday and called me on Sunday. "I love it," she said. I knew that she did not mean it was perfect. I knew there were months of intensive rewriting ahead, but you cannot imagine the joy with which I heard those words. I know very well that I am capable of writing a bad book, but I have never in my right mind believed that Virginia would publish one. She loved Jacob, and as I began the painstaking revisions, I came to love it too, until though I never managed to bring it to perfection, I felt that it was the best that I could do. My child had grown up and must, at long last, be let go. An earnest young reporter asked me, "What are you trying to do when you write for children?" "I'm trying to write as well as I possibly can," I answered. He thought I hadn't understood his question. "No, no," he said, "what I mean is, what is your philosophy of writing for children? Isn't there some moral you want to get across to them? Aren't there some values you wish to instill in your young readers?" "I'm trying," I said, "to write for my readers the best story, the truest story of which I am capable." He gave up on me and changed the subject, frustrated and annoyed. He seemed to share the view of many intelligent, well-educated, well-meaning people that while adult literature may aim to be art, the object of children's books is to whip the little rascals into shape. But you and I know better. We know that those of us who write for children are called not to do something to a child, but to be someone for a child. Art, in Francis Clark Sayer's wonderfully passionate definition, is a controlled fury of desire to share one's private revelation of life. And she, the librarian, summons us who are writers to the service of art, to give the best that is in us to the audience that lives by what it feeds upon. Among my notes, I found this one written while I was stalled one day during August of 1979. I can date it because it is written on Jean Nimovich's electric typewriter and is full of stray L's and K's. There is another sibling rivalry in the story of Jacob. It is, of course, the story of Leah and Rachel. Jacob have I loved. poor Leah, the homely elder sister, married in trickery to the man passionately in love with her younger sister. She goes to his bed and must lie there and bear his seeing who she is. Watch his face as the truth of his father-in-law's treachery dawns, his disappointment. How does he react? What does he say? Even if, and it is hard to believe, he might have been. Even if in his own disappointment he remembers her pain and tries to be tactful and kind, that very kindness would be next to unbearable if Leah loves him at all. Esau's grief is nothing compared to Leah's. She must watch her husband go joyfully to her sister and joylessly come to her. But God does give her many sons. That would be a comfort if we did not know that Rachel, who only has two sons, is the mother of Joseph, that younger brother of all younger brothers. This puts a new dimension into the phrase, "Jacob have I loved." It is a woman speaking now, a wronged and grieving woman, not God. The loving is not here a matter of divine election, but of the eternal weight of women who have neither the beauty of Rachel nor the cleverness of Rebecca. What shall we do for the Leahs? The only thing I can do for the Leahs, the Esaus, and the Louises, is to give them now, while they are young, the best, the truest story of which I am capable. I have learned, for all my failings and limitations, that when I am willing to give myself away in a book, readers will respond by giving themselves away as well. And the book that I labored over so long becomes, in our mutual giving, something far richer and more powerful than I could ever have imagined. I thank you, and I thank God, that I have been allowed to take part in this miracle once again. And now, if you will excuse me, I have this book I want to write.